Hello, friends. Welcome once again to the Perfect Bound Podcast. This is a podcast all about anything and everything comic books and comics related, brought to you by the Panel Jumper and Comics Dungeon. My name is Ben. With me, as always, is Nicole Lamb.
Hello.
Chris Kso.
Hello.
And Mr. Cole Hornaday.
Salutations.
Hey. And today we have a special guest joining us via Skype is Mr. Ron Randall. Hi, Ron.
Hello.
So, to take us the rest of the way, I'm going to put us in the capable hands of Mr. Cole Hornaday.
Absolutely. I want to give a little introduction to y'all, Ron's personal history and career. Ron Randall is a graduate of the Kubert School. His first published comic book work was a two-page backup story titled Killers Above, Killers Below, which was written by Robert Kaniger and appeared in Unknown Soldier number 243 in September of 1980. For over 30 years, Ron has contributed art to DC titles like The Warlord, Arrax, Son of Thunder, Swamp Thing, Justice League Europe, and Wonder Woman. And he's also contributed to Marvel properties like Venom, What If, and Star Trek Unlimited. But Ron is probably most famous for his creator-owned series, Trekker, the story of a 23rd century female government-sanctioned bounty hunter named Mercy St. Clair, who works and resides in the city of New Gelliff. Trekker first appeared in Dark Horse Presents number 4 in January 1987 and became one of the most significant female protagonists of that day and probably any day. And please note, the title was not named for, nor is it to be confused with fans of the Star Trek franchise.
That was my first question. Gosh.
Well, just had to nip that one in the bud for you, pal. Ron has returned to Trekker numerous times over the decades, publishing stories through Dark Horse, Image, and ultimately landing on a Kickstarter crowdsourced to print model. And we're going to learn more about that as we go on. Ron, thank you so much for being with us. I touched base with you at Emerald City Comic Con this last year at the behest of our mutual friend Steve Mattson. Mm-hmm. As I was rereading, I did a deep dive into the Trekker comics over the last couple of weeks, and there were a lot of names that were familiar to me because Steve and I did theater together at Western Oregon State College. I was still in high school, but Steve was studying art. And also Dave Jackson was one of your early letterers, and Dave was a very good friend of mine as well. Yeah, and I just saw Dave 2 summers ago, and we're still connected on Facebook. But yeah, it brought back a lot of lovely memories. So anyway, let me get started on some questions here.
Actually, I have a first question.
Sir, go for it.
Ron, is everything Cole said in your intro correct?
And what did I mispronounce?
No. I was going to say that was shockingly well researched. Well done. In fact, I had forgotten that it was that first story I did came out in 1980. That's a little bit of a sobering fact.
But, brother, it's on your wiki page, so it has to be true.
Right.
All right, Cole, take it away.
All right, well, speaking of the history of Dark Horse Comics, you were one of the earliest contributors to Dark Horse Presents. Give us a little bit of an idea, an overview, what it was like working at Dark Horse Comics in those early days.
How's the best way to put it? It was simple, direct, informal, and very easy. Back then, Dark Horse was essentially 3 or 4 guys in a little office off of a fairly busy boulevard here in Portland. And I would just pop in. It was like basically one sort of large open room and a couple of smaller rooms where the doors are always open. Mm-hmm. And so it was very much, I don't want to belittle it because Mike Richardson from the very beginning was running it like it was a professional outfit. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, there was sort of a little bit of almost like a sort of a clubhouse feel to it. It was spontaneous. People were sort of, sort of making it up as they went along. And I just think a lot of it was going by Mike's gut feeling about the comic books that he would like to do and was the most enthusiastic about. So,
and that was Mike's first foray into publishing, right? Because he ran comic book stores in Portland before that. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. He had, I don't remember, maybe 2 or 3 different comic shops at the time. And they published a one-off novelty comic, Boris the Bear Slaughters the Radioactive Hamsters or something.
James Dean Smith.
Yeah, by James Dean Smith. And it was, it became a huge hit. This is back in, at the beginning of what was a sadly short-lived heyday of independent little black and white comic companies. Mm-hmm. And so they put out the Boris the Bear book, and I think it probably surprised just about everybody at the huge success it was, largely because it was kind of clever, but it also was right place, right time. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so that basically, I think, sort of gave Mike the financial resources to really settle into to starting a comic book company in earnest.
So. I'm gonna throw the Chris into the breach here and have him ask a question next.
No worries. Trekker's World. Please tell us about the genesis of Trekker and Mercy St. Clair. What inspired you to create the character, and why do you keep coming back to her story?
Okay, how much time do you got? I'll try to be concise.
We got to record a couple other episodes tonight. So.
Yeah, right. Theoretically, I'm a professional storyteller, which means I should be able to select detail and make the story pretty concise. We'll see. This will be a good test for me. So the genesis of Trekker, I had just moved back from my years where I'd lived on the East Coast to go to the Kubert School and get started in get my foot in the door, so to speak, at Marvel and DC. I just moved back here to Portland, and talk about right place, the right time. I was here the summer that got back the summer that Dark Horse was just starting up. So Mike Richardson and Randy Stradley sauntered up to me at a local comic books convention that I had found about fairly recently and was invited to be a guest at. So I'm sitting there at my table. They come up, they introduce themselves, say they're starting a little comic book company and wanted to get some professional creators from DC and Marvel to come and do some work for them. And they said to me, because I'm thinking, okay, I don't know these guys. I've never heard of Dark Horse Comics, of course. It hadn't existed. Why would I leave a steady, regular monthly gig drawing the Warlord comic for DC? Mm-hmm. Because for those of your listeners who may not have, whose memories may not go back that far, let me just put it that way. Back then, if you wanted to work in comic books, that's what you wanted.
Right.
You wanted
right.
a regular monthly gig at Marvel or DC, because that was kind of what the industry was. And I had one of them. So,
as a good spotlight.
Yeah, I cannot remember whether it was Mike or Randy, but one of them said to me the sentence that's sort of like kryptonite for any comics creator. They said, if you come and work for us, we will pay you your rate and you can do whatever you want.
That's and gold right myself, there.
Yeah. I said to myself, I will never hear that sentence again in my life. And I was right. So I really had to start thinking about it, because I thought, well, you know, who knows? Maybe this little company is going to be going to put out a few comics and go out of business. Why would I leave DC to do this? But I kept thinking about that. Gee, I'll never have a shot like this to basically just craft my dream project and have somebody willing to pay me money to do it. I just thought about what would my dream project be. Well, I've always loved science fiction, and back then there were very few science fiction comics being done, so the opportunities to work in science fiction were few and far between. I was drawn to the idea about placing a young woman in a very dark, gritty, violent science fiction setting as the beginning of a series, an opening gambit, and then craft a series that would gradually evolve and have her character gradually grow and evolve over time, being shaped by her experiences, and sort of see what happens to her as a human being over the course of the long haul. So, I wanted a story with explosions and spaceships and crash landing on swamp planets. And I also wanted a story that was basically a long form sort of character study. So I put all that into a proposal and sent it into Dark Horse. And they, for some reason, because they were also sort of relatively young and naive, I think, rather than saying, that's a clever idea, Ron, but we don't know how to sell a book like that, or we don't know if there's an audience for that or whatever, they just said, that sounds cool, do it. Mm-hmm. So when you say, what was it like working for Dark Horse? That's kind of what it was like working for Dark
Got
Horse.
It.
I think that if Mike read a concept and he thought it was solid and it's something that he thought would make a good comic book, a fun comic book, He would try to find a way to make it happen. So
right.
that's what Trekker got started.
Just like I tell you,
One other thing I wanted to say, because you mentioned the whole Star Trek thing, the unfortunate similarity in the mix. And my disclaimer about that is that this conversation I had with Mike and Randy, and what started me thinking about this comic book, happened when the original Star Trek series had been off the air for about 20 years, nothing was happening with Star Trek. I think a movie had come out, but that was like, back then comics and movies weren't very closely related. So from my perspective, Star Trek was kind of a dormant property. Nothing was happening with it. So, and I was trying to think what I would call my series, and I wanted a name that had sort of some harsh sounds, sounds in it, K's and T's, hard letters, because that's a dramatic sound. And anyway, somehow I came up with Trekker, and I thought, oh, that could be a cool name. That's what they could, that could be the slang term for bounty hunters in this version of the future. And it works on the level of you're tracking down the bad guy. She's also on this longer track of self-discovery, whether she wants to be or not. So I crafted it, pitched the proposal. It gets approved. We start working on the first story, and then who is Paramount or Fox announces Star Trek: The Next Generation is coming out. And I'm thinking, well, that is pretty bad timing for Ron, but the ball was already rolling by that time. So
Have you ever been approached by Paramount or anybody else about the name?
No. The only thing that's happened is occasionally.
Two keys, Ben.
Yeah. occasionally, well, some fan will come up at a show and they'll say, "Oh, Trekker, is that having to do with Star Trek?" And say, "Nope."
Right.
So yeah. Other than the fact that it's another science fiction story,
The impact of Trekker back in '87 was pretty significant for me because there were so few female action adventure protagonists on the newsstand, but also I always wanted to encourage whoever I was dating at the time to read comics along with me, but it was really frustrating for both of us to walk into a comic book store and there really was not a book that spoke to my SO at the time. And between the 80s and 90s, I went through a lot of them. So I went through a lot of Trekker comics.
Maybe if you didn't try to force them to read comics.
There you go. But it was, the response was always unanimous. This is terrific. I wish there were more books like this on the stand. So why a female protagonist? What spoke to you to write a female character?
There's a lot of things I think that went into it. One very obvious one, a real influence on my vision for Trekker was before I did Trekker, a couple of years earlier, I had been lucky enough to have my first sort of regular gig in comics was a backup in the Warlord comic book. A couple of years later, I was drawing the lead feature, but originally it was a backup called The Barren Earth. And it was created by me and a writer named Gary Cohn, who also co-created the Blue Devil at DC. But it was a science fiction series, had a female lead character, and Gary and I developed a series together. That one had sort of a lot of Edgar Rice Burroughs sort of flavor to it. The sun is starting to go red giant, and so there was sort of like a desert planet. Anyway, so that was an experience where I got to draw a female lead character who was center stage. I mean, she was a lead character. She wasn't like the sexy sidekick or the love interest or the an afterthought character. The story was about her, and I really enjoyed having that be the case. Other stories I'd drawn where there was a female character, they tended to be some sort of window dressing, so to speak, for the story. And I was always thinking, well, what's her story? I don't know why, but I had this interest in having the female character be sort of center focus. And I just didn't see it happening much in comics. So having gotten a taste of it in that work I did with Gary, when I had a chance to create my own series, I said, I want to do more of that. And like you say, there wasn't a lot of that going around. And when there was a comic that featured a female character prominently, a lot of times, those were excuses to just have cheesecake drawings. The sexy babe comics with, cleavage and high heel shoes prancing around in hot pants or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I drew plenty of those comics, too, because that was kind of like the vocabulary of the time. But when I created Trekker, I knew it was going to be a very intense process because I was going to have to write and draw the stories. Mm-hmm. And I was going to have to build and create a world that I wouldn't get bored with or tired of. And part of that, to me, it meant it had to feel real and believable. And that meant if she's going to be a bounty hunter, she's got to dress like somebody's going out to catch, mass murderers. She's not going to be wearing high-heeled shoes and hot pants. She's going to be dressed with gear, and she's going to be dressed to take tumbles and crash through walls and, face plants on the asphalt or whatever, because the job entails that sort of stuff, right? So I designed a character whose costume felt to me functional and believable. Mm-hmm. And that sort of sensibility carried through with the way I tried to write her character. I just tried to write her like a human being who would have recognizable responses to situations. And I was really gratified because a lot of what you were saying, you know, the conversations that you would have with girlfriends, mm-hmm. I heard some of that at conventions. I would have guys come up to me at conventions back then and say, kind of the same what you just said. I love comics. I'm trying to get my girlfriend to read comic books. Trek is one of the few books I can show her without feeling I have to apologize for it.
Absolutely.
And, and that was not why I created Trekker, but it was absolutely part of the values I was, you know, trying to create in this series. That was the sort of response that was right down the center of the line about what I was hoping for.
Cool. Chris, did you have another question?
On the same subject, because you've been successful with handling female characters, did collaborating with writers like Gail Simone in any way inform how you wrote them going forward?
With Gail, a little bit. Gail's a terrific writer. Unfortunately, I didn't get to work very closely with Gail very much. I did some work on the Wonder Woman issues, but I was sort of brought in to help out on a project that was already, you know, like that was a thoroughbred. That sucker was racing down the track, and all I had to do was help keep it along. But but earlier than that, I mean, right from the beginning of my career, I worked with some extraordinary women editors. Karen Berger, who's basically, you know, well, not basically, she did. She was the reason Vertigo existed.
Right.
She was the one who, you know, brought Alan Moore over to begin writing Swamp Thing, which revolutionized, I think, comic book writing in America the same way that when Neil Adams had hit maybe 10 years earlier, sort of began to revolutionize the way art was approaching comics. It just upped the stakes. And Karen is as sharp as they come with amazing comics instincts and a really clear vision, and a strong sense for female characters, of course. And then years later, when I was working on Trekker, I had the incredible good fortune to have Diana Schutz edit one of my, a pretty major, significant Trekker story, and she gave some great feedback and input on how to reshape some scenes and sequences that just made the story 100 times better.
Oh, cool.
So throughout my career, I've had some pretty darn good experiences working with females, more as editors than writer collaborations.
Gotcha. Yeah. We'll return a little bit more on Trekker, but since we're kind of, you know, talking about collaborations and mm-hmm. working with others, back in 2002, you helped found Mercury Studio, which went on to become Periscope Studios and then Helioscope Studios.
Right.
We don't often hear about studio setups much these days for comic creators, so I was wondering if you could talk to us a little bit about that. What are the benefits, how it impacts your output, and what kind of collaborative experiences you've possibly had because of the studio setup?
I mean, is it just a party shack, or are you guys actually getting work?
it is the opposite of a party shack, except we do also sometimes. What the studio is, it's basically a shared space. It's we sort of figure that if you call it sort of an artist sort of co-op, that's kind of gets the sense of it. Everybody has their own space. We all sort of rent out a portion of this. This large studio space that we have, and everybody is sort of running their own career. We're all self-employed, independent, you know, contractors. So we're not like a corporation and that or that sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. It's been such an incredible resource for my career. I'm working in a studio with a bunch of other artists, a wide range of ages, backgrounds, experiences, artistic styles and approaches, temperaments, personalities. It's very stimulating. Everybody there is creative. They're some of the most enjoyable people I know. We were incredibly fortunate when we started out that we had a group of people that meshed pretty well. And as we've grown, we've been very intentional about trying to find people who are a good fit, both professionally and personally, to keep the space a good, comfortable one, because not a party house. It's a place where people go to get work done. If you want to survive in this business, you have to be able to work regularly and efficiently over long stretches of time. So you're in the studio working away, and some days not a word is said for hours. Everybody is working away on their own. They got their headphones on, or they just lost in their own world. And then a conversation will break out, and sometimes it lasts a few minutes, and other times it turns into it's almost becomes like a comedy routine where people are tossing in one-liners and cracking everybody up, and it can get kind of boisterous. And then it'll settle down again, and everybody's back in that workspace again. But at the end of the day, the studio only has value if it's a way to nurture our productivity. The basic sensibility we have there is pragmatic solutions. Nobody there is particularly precious about their art process, or their tools. It's a pragmatic approach to getting it done, because that's what you have to have to survive in the long haul doing this kind of a thing.
Right.
So we're always, somebody will discover some new tool to use in Clip Paint Studio, or a new file sharing protocol or something like that, and that information gets shared, and we all tend to benefit from it.
Nice.
So who all do you share the studio with currently?
Oh, there's a big list, isn't it? Yeah. About 25 of us.
Oh, is that right? I didn't realize there's that many people.
It's,
oh my goodness.
Huge. Yeah. Steve Lieber is in there, Jeff Parker, Paul Tobin, Colleen Coover, who are a couple that have created Bandette.
Dylan McConis, I think.
Dylan McConis is in there. Erica Moen is in there. Lucy Bellwood is there.
All of Nicole's favorite people.
So many Layla cool people.
Layla Del Duca is in the studio with us. It just goes on. Kat Ferris is in there, who just did My Boyfriend is a Bear, which is one of the
my favorite
Amazon's
thing ever.
Like,
didn't you review that a couple weeks ago?
I scream it from the rafters how much I love that book.
Maria Franz is there, who just did a book called Chancellor of the Citadel that just came out. And so we have a lot of artists that I say run the gamut of ages. Some of us have decades of experience in the industry. Some of us are just sort of at the beginning of their careers, or the cusp of their first flush of being super busy and having to field offers and stuff like that. So we all sort of swap notes and exchange experiences and perspectives, and I just think it's incredibly enriching.
Sounds like a fun, collaborative, co-working environment.
Yeah.
It really is. I think that we all are wise enough to recognize how incredibly fortunate we are. We just genuinely enjoy each other's company. When it turns out that one of us is going to a convention, and we find out that one of our studio mates is going to be at the same convention, it's like you've automatically got a great buddy to be tabling next to at the show. things like that. So it's really pretty great.
So in 2011, you launched TrekkerComic.com, a website collection of all the previously published Trekker material, and you made them available free to the public. What was the thinking by putting all that work out there for free?
I figured if I put out there and try to build up some sort of pay firewall, first of all, either nobody would find it or see it, or it wouldn't work anyway. I had seen cases where somebody would post something like that, but once somebody has access to it, there are ways to download that stuff and rebundle it up, and then put it out again. And somebody's going to put PDFs out there. And so, I didn't see a good money-making vehicle to make it work, as a, pay-to-view sort of webcomic or something. Mm-hmm. When I launched it as a webcomic, I did it for, basically it was because, Trekker had been sitting on a shelf for about 12 years at that point.
Right.
I had always known that I had to get back and tell the rest of this young woman's story. I owed it to myself. I owed it to the readers. At every convention I go to, people would come up to me and say, when are you going to do more Trekker? I got tired of hearing it. I got tired of not working. Yeah, really.
Annoyance.
And so this happened because I was in the studio and I kept hearing a few of the people like Dylan and Erica and a few others were talking about their webcomic. And I finally realized, oh yeah, the internet exists. I can make I've got all these pages. I've got 200 and some pages of original Trekker art sitting in a closet in my studio at home. So I just said I could scan those in and launch it as a webcomic, making the pages available for free so that it could start to be returned to the landscape, you know, the comic book landscape, and get some visibility and maybe start to get some eyeballs on it. And the other crucial thing that I did is that I declared that once I'd finished posting all the existing pages, I would have the beginning, the next story would start to post immediately after that. So in other words, I gave myself a deadline and I declared it publicly. So I exposed myself to public shame and humiliation if I blew my deadline.
Because as also a professional, a good motivator.
Yes. Yeah, as a professional comic book artist, I am pretty motivated to not miss my deadlines. It's, mm-hmm. I mean, that was something Joe drilled into us mercilessly back at the Kubert School. A professional hits those deadlines. So, and the motivation worked. I had the first new Trekker story started rolling out right after I finished posting the last of the previously existed pages, and it was just thrilling to get back to it.
So did you scan all those pages of Trekker yourself?
Okay. The thing about having a studio is we had some mentees that would come into the studio. And we would teach them tricks. We would teach them things about the trade, and they would fetch us a cup of coffee or in some cases scan in pages for us.
Nice.
So here's the thing. I scanned in the pages and those worked fine for a web format. But then a couple years later when Dark Horse decided that, you know, when I reconnected with Dark Horse to get the books back into print, we wanted to put a collection of all those earlier stories. So we put out a Trekker omnibus. Problem was that most of those earlier stories had been done for black and white, and I used a thing called Zip-A-Tone, mm-hmm. which they used back in the day, like in newspapers strips. You'll see this dot patterns and line patterns that were on these peel-off stickable sort of like decal sheets.
Sure.
And you could put down these things down for textures and values on the original art, which worked fine with the old traditional printing process. But when you scan things in, unless they're scanned in at a very high resolution, those dot patterns get weird. It's called a Mori pattern.
Yeah, get Mori patterns, sure.
And so the Dark Horse people said, gee, it's too bad we don't have really high quality, you know, high resolution scans of these pages. They would look a lot better. And I said, I'll be there in 20 minutes. So I put all the original in my car, drove it down to the Dark Horse offices, and then they scanned it into like some insane like 1200 DPI resolution.
Cool.
So so thank goodness I had kept all the originals is the bottom line.
Wow. Nice.
So what inspired you to take it to the crowdsourcing level? Was that your plan when you got them all up and running online?
Oh no, my plan. I only had the first step of the plan, which was to make the webcomic and get the ball rolling that way. And then I had the, whatever you want to call it, the vision or the hope of getting it back into print. But how that would happen, I did not know. As I say, initially it worked out well to team up again with Dark Horse, and that worked out great. Except that after we'd put out the omnibus and a couple of other trades, it was becoming clear that getting a Trekker book to come out through Dark Horse, it would come out when they felt they could accommodate within their publishing schedule. Mm-hmm. And since Trekker is not a massive, you know, top-selling book, that would happen not as regularly as Ron wanted it to happen.
Right.
So I had, and as I was saying, I was posting a new, I maybe didn't say this, but I post a new page on the website every Monday, so that every week a new page comes out. And I had gotten to the point where I had the next issues of material had been done and sitting waiting for Dark Horse to decide when they could put it on the schedule. And it was driving me nuts, because again, it was back to the case where a book would come out, and then an interval of time would happen before I could get another issue out. I didn't know how long that interval was going to be, and it was just sort of very frustrating. So finally, I said, it's just going to take so long between volumes at this rate that I might be dead before I get to the end of this story. And that was an unsatisfactory scenario. So I finally said, well, I'm going to have to see how I had no idea whether or not there would be enough support to fund a Kickstarter. But I felt that was what I had to try. I owed it to myself. I owed it to the series and and mostly I think I owe it to the fans to try to get this book to come out on a regular basis, because it's the idea is each story is self-contained, but you string them all together, and that's when it also traces the gradual arc, the evolution of this character. Mm-hmm. And if multi-year long gaps happen between the stories, that doesn't serve anybody well.
Right.
So that's why I turned to the Kickstarters. On a wing and a prayer, I held my breath and hit the launch button.
So what did you discover about your fan base and the community support you actually had out there from the first Kickstarter?
That it was enthusiastic and powerful enough to sustain to sustain that first Kickstarter.
Did that surprise you?
Yeah, it did. I knew, as I say, that I had some Trekker fans that had remembered the book fondly from back in the day and were leaving some comments on the Trekker comic website. And it was when I'd go to conventions, people were happy to see it, but I didn't know what the size of that would be. I don't have a massive, you know, tens of thousands of followers on Twitter and Facebook and that sort of stuff. I have followers, but not in the numbers that I thought, oh, that's probably something that will translate. So, I set my funding target and built as smart a campaign as I could by picking the brains of everybody I knew who had experience running Kickstarters, because I knew that I didn't know the first thing about it when I came up with the idea to do this. But I honestly thought I might be coming down to the last day of the Kickstarter campaign and still be thousands of dollars away from my initial goal, because I'd seen that happen with other people. So I was pretty apprehensive, but I just felt I had to do it. So I hit the launch button, and it hit its funding goal in a day and a half.
Oh, so nice.
Yeah. So
that's amazing.
I was hugely relieved, and then just went on to add stretch goals and increase the support that way. And then when I launched the second campaign, it hit its funding goal in 9 hours. So that was also great. I've been very
grateful for social media.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So you sell the books. Do you just sell the books on Etsy, or have you gotten distribution for them, or what are you doing with that?
Yeah, no, I don't have a distribution deal. The books are available on my Etsy store through the Kickstarter campaigns, and if you see me at a convention. And that is the one thing that I would love to have that I have not figured out a practical way to go about doing yet, and that is to get the books, you know, into comic book shops or
I have a fond dream that one day Kickstarter will figure out that they can become a distributor for the creators, and I could order from Kickstarter as well. So
yeah, that would be great.
Go ahead, Ron. I'm sorry.
No, I was just going to say that would be great. I love the fact that, and I didn't think that I would, but I love the fact that if you're a creator and you use Kickstarter, maybe the most powerful experience of that is this sense of direct contact you have with your readers,
sure,
with your supporters, and the sense of a personal relationship. Oh, for my group, I call us the Trekker community, because it feels like a community. These people are engaged in dialogue with me. They ask questions. They react enthusiastically when they hear I'm going to be appearing at a convention near them, or when another Kickstarter is going to happen. So I feel that sense of support and enthusiasm for my project. It's a very personal, almost an intimate kind of relationship that is really powerful. And that direct contact is a real, it's a real rush. Mm-hmm. And so that's great. The thing that you miss is that, you know, being able to get the book seen more widely. A kid can't have or a person can't have the experience of walking into a comic book shop and stumbling upon the latest issue of Trekker. And that's, they can do it if they're messing around online and they go to Kickstarter and, oh, here's a, you know, project we love. Oh, what's this thing? So that does happen, and that's great. But I'm an analog kind of guy. I like things happening in the real world as much as possible. So I'd love to see that happen somehow.
So Ron, what's next for Mercy? It looks like she's evolved considerably since 1987. Where is she going from here?
Into the next story. She has evolved, but it's all been gradual, one step at a time sort of stuff. She was, as you pointed out in your very, very concise and thorough introduction, she begins on the streets of a crime-ridden sci-fi noir city, New Galef. But her travels and adventures have taken her far afield and expanded the worldview and stuff. So now she's currently traveling in outer space on questions and answers into her past that are going to be big revelations for her. She's had some already, and the hits are going to keep on coming.
And doesn't she have a girlfriend now, too?
Yeah, that's something that I had in the work in the series for a very long time. Mm. I mean, when I say I had in the works, I had felt I'd planted the seeds with the intention of getting there, and then there were these long hiatuses between the stories. So when I got back to it, I felt I wanted to do a little bit more of laying the groundwork so that personal revelation would come across, hopefully, and feel, again, just sort of real, I wanted the readers to get the visceral sense of the power of that moment. And I didn't know if I was, you know, when you write something, when I envision something like that, I'm not sure if it's going to come if it's going to come across to the readers the way I intend it to. But I was really gratified with the response from readers when they mostly saw that and said, finally, you know, so, which is exactly, of course, the response I was hoping for. So I was really gratified about that. So, yeah, so Mercy has realized that she has been in love with her friend, her best friend, Molly. And Molly is like a musician. She has nothing to do with Mercy's violent world. So why was she always making time to get together with Molly to have a glass of wine or just talk about how difficult her day was going or something like that? So I was trying to plant those seeds. Anyway, so yeah, that was a big thing. And now with Molly at her side, they're going out and trying to craft a life and find a place in this big world that's gotten more complex and dangerous as time has gone on. So what's up next is on May 28th, I launched my third Kickstarter for a story called Trekker Battlefields, where that quest that Mercy takes her on is going to land her in the darkest, most remote quadrant of the galaxy, and she winds up sailing into the middle of a war zone. So the fun thing to do as a storyteller is to take your character and, you know, pull them out of their comfortable settings, as I did when I had her fall in love with when she fell in love with Molly. That's, you know, that's a level of emotional intimacy that she has never gotten to with anybody else in the previous relationship I'd shown. And part of the fun of that has been showing how often she's completely off balance in this relationship, because she's perfectly safe in it. But that's just great to have her so much a fish out of water. In a way, this story where she goes to this war zone is similar. She's just tracking down bad guys and stuff, but you know, she's not used to fighting armies, so sort of upping the stakes in the story in a lot of ways.
Cool. Well, Ron, we really appreciate you joining us. If people want to find your Kickstarter, what's the best place? What's the best URL they can visit?
The easiest one to remember that I could create, which is trekkerkickstarter.com. So if you go there, right, it'll take you right to the campaign.
And they can purchase previously printed material at your Etsy page, correct?
That's right. And or on the Kickstarter. I have the last couple of previous volumes that I funded through the Kickstarter are also available at different reward levels on the campaign. And there's also the Etsy store, etsy.com/shop/RonRandallArt or something like that. But you can search for me on Etsy and it'll come up.
And we'll definitely put a link to that in the show notes. Absolutely. For this episode. Ron Randall, fantastic. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank
we really
you
appreciate
thank
it.
You.
I've had a great time. Thank you, guys. It's been a great conversation.
I appreciate
Thanks.
It. Absolutely.
Thank you so much for listening. Thank you again to Ron Randall for joining us. Again, you can find his Kickstarter at trekkerkickstarter.com. That's our show. The Perfect Bound Podcast is brought to you by The Panel Jumper. See everything Cole Hornaday and I do at thepaneljumper.com, as well as Comics Dungeon here at 319 Northeast 45th Street in beautiful downtown Wallingford, or 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at comicsdungeon.com. Subscribe to the show on iTunes or however you get your podcast at perfectboundpodcast.com. Send us an email, perfectboundpodcast@gmail.com. Thank you again for listening, and we will see you next week. Woo-hoo!